The following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, originally airing September 29th, 2023. What does the recent salute in the Canadian House of Commons of a Ukrainian who served on the Nazi side tell us about the direction of our policies toward Ukraine? How has NATO jeopardized any ability to direct foreign policy democratically? Is President Zelensky a heroic figure or a tool of U.S. intelligence? How could recent visits to Russia help shape the perspectives of Canadians and Americans devoted to the destruction of so-called misinformed, war-happy citizens of the country? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we continue with an update on the situation in Ukraine, where the war is headed, and what it says about Canada's participation in it. In our first half hour, we will be talking to peace activist Tamara Lorentz about how Canada's foreign policy has been shaped by its involvement in NATO and about her visit to Russia late last year. In our second half hour, military analyst and commentator Scott Ritter returns to the show to share his thoughts about the looming demise of the war, the creation of the Ukraine Reconstructive Bank, and also about his trip to Russia in late April, early May. On this week's program, the war is ending, and Canada lauds a Nazi as a Ukrainian hero. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 29th, 2023. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji, Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. After settlers from Europe in the last five centuries colonized the land of Indigenous people and committed acts of genocide and colonialism, it is time to redress the imbalance between the peoples and make reparations a responsibility moving forward. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Another point of the Republican pushback against the Biden administration's reckless funding plan for Ukraine is the consistently made promise by Trump to quickly find a resolution to end the conflict if he is elected for another term, with the latest made on September 25th at a rally in South Carolina. Furthermore, the former president declared that he would strive to avoid a third world war, stressing that the current situation is very close to a global conflict. A new Washington Post ABC poll shows Joe Biden trailing Trump by 10 percentage points. This is inconvenient news for the establishment media, who responded aggressively to the poll, saying it was flawed. For his part, Larry Sabato, the director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, called the decision to release the poll results, quote, ridiculous, unquote. That comes from the article. Latest poll shows Trump up 10 points over Biden for 2024 election, by Ahmed Adel, posted September 28th, originally published on InfoBricks. Amply documented, Svoboda, together with the, quote, right sector, unquote, or Pravi sector, were actively involved in the 2014 Euromaidan massacre. The founders of Ukraine's Svoboda Party are Ole Tyanybok and Andriy Paruby. Both individuals have played a role in shaping the Kiev regime. Deputy Speaker and Speaker Andriy Paruby of the Verkhovna Rada, or the Ukrainian Parliament, from 2016 to 2019, was received by Trudeau at the House of Commons in February 2016. Paruby also met up with members of Trudeau's cabinet, including Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland. That comes from the three-part report under the headline, Ukraine, Has PM Trudeau Succumbed to Nazi Ideology? By Hindustan Times, Sky News, and Professor Michelle Chalsadovsky, posted September 27th, originally published in Hindustan Times, Sky News, and Global Research. If Dr. Scholier were to speak up and raise concerns about COVID-19 mRNA vaccines and turbo cancer, he would be denounced by the media that currently adore him. He would be denounced by the politicians and the entire Australian medical establishment that is currently giving him the red carpet treatment. His doctor colleagues would turn their back on him, and they would almost certainly leave him to die. That includes his surgeon colleagues, his oncology colleagues, and his longtime cancer research collaborators. The only reason Dr. Scholier is being treated well by the medical establishment is because he is helping them advance a multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical fraud, failed mRNA vaccines. In this case, Moderna's mRNA cancer vaccines. That comes from the article. 56-year-old Australian Dr. Richard Scholier was diagnosed with worst possible brain turbo cancer. He's now receiving world's first mRNA cancer vaccine to treat mRNA turbo cancer. By Dr. William Mackus, posted September 27th, originally published on COVID Intel. The illustration showed a, quote, new Middle East, unquote, wherein the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip appeared to be part of Israel. An earlier erroneous map shown by Netanyahu also included the Palestinian territories as part of Israel in 1948. Israel did not control the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, or the Gaza Strip following its violent creation in 1948 on 80% of historic Palestine. It illegally occupied them in 1967 and continues to do so in what is known as the longest occupation in modern history. The inclusion of Palestinian lands and sometimes land belonging to Syria and Lebanon in Israeli maps is common among believers of the concept of Eretz Yisrael, Greater Israel, a key part of ultra-nationalist Zionism that claims all of these lands belong to a Zionist state. That comes from the article, Israel, Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu promotes normalization with new map erasing Palestine. Posted September 27th, originally published on Middle East Eye.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
A week ago, a Ukrainian war veteran from World War II was honored in the Canadian House of Commons while Ukrainian President Zelensky was entertained. This veteran, it turns out, served in the 14th Waffen Grenadier Division of the SS, a unit created by the Nazis from Ukrainian volunteers in 1943 as part of its occupation of the USSR. Speaker Anthony Rota has stepped down from his role as Speaker, and Prime Minister Trudeau has expressed apologies. However, the damage has been done. As it stands at this time, Polish authorities are calling for the extradition of this man. One entertainer, Rod Schneider, suddenly canceled his trip to Canada on account of the salute, and most other nations of the world look in extreme sadness at the bizarre spectacle of gentle Canada suddenly locking hands with Nazis. Such are the extremes of their hatred of Russia. Meanwhile,
the war has just kept going. Ukrainians and Russians continue to die by the hundreds of thousands now. Yet this stubborn legend persists that Canada is a nation of peacekeepers, not warmongers. But our next guest will tell you that this country is as determined a hawk as anyone else. So what's left for people who want to see that situation change? Tamara Lawrence is a member of Canadian Voice of Women for Peace, a PhD candidate with the Belsilly School of International Affairs at Wilfrid Laurier University, and a fellow with the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. And she's also a rising star in Canada among peace groups, I believe, in the country, as she is raising awareness about the unjust aspects of the war in Ukraine and speaking out as fearlessly as anyone else. So I thought we'd bring her back to comment on where Ukraine and Canadian foreign policy is at the current time. It's good to have you back tomorrow, Lawrence. So welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
Maybe I should start with the story that's dominating the news right now. Your thoughts about the disclosure of a Ukraine soldier being on the side of the Nazis, being tagged by the Speaker of the House as a Ukrainian hero, a Canadian hero, fighting, quote, for Ukrainian independence against the Russians, unquote.
Well, it's very disappointing, but it's not surprising, and it's to be expected. So on Friday, when President Zelensky was in Parliament, our Speaker of the House honored a Ukrainian Canadian a veteran who served with the Waffen-SS Galicia Division during the Second World War. He served with the Nazis. He trained in Germany. And every single member of parliament, everyone in the House of Commons stood up and cheered as this Nazi was honored, and it's absolutely disgraceful. But I think that it is part of a broader project of historical revisionism that's happening in this country, and it really represents a creeping fascism that I see. It's something that I also witnessed when I was touring Eastern Europe last year and went through Latvia, Poland, and Romania. And I think Canadians should be very concerned about what took place. As well, Canadians should know that what we have been doing in Ukraine with the Canadian military since 2015, we've had a training mission called Operation Unifier in Ukraine. And there's evidence that I have through access to information documents that the Canadian military knew that it was arming and training neo-Nazi forces in Ukraine. This is members of Azov, C-14, right sector. These are neo-Nazi militias that have been integrated into the Ukrainian military. And we've been supporting them for the past 8 years, and this is another aspect to this problem of neo-Nazism that we see as well. Last year, there was a vote that came out in the UN General Assembly asking countries to denounce Nazism, and Canada refused to support that vote. So we need to have deep introspection about where we're going in this country and what we're doing. And Canadians should be outraged. And as well on Friday, not only should we be condemning this glorification of a Nazi in the House of Parliament, but Canadians should also be denouncing the fact that we have, the federal government has announced another $650 million to prolong this war in Ukraine. So Canadians are spending more public funds for weapons, for this terrible war that we see raging in that country. Canadians have spent in the past 18 months over $9 billion for a war. We haven't spent $1 for peace. There are a lot of problems that were revealed on Friday, and Canadians really need to pause and think about where we are as a country and the direction that we're going. And I would like to also add that there is a misperception among Canadians that we are a peacekeeping country. It's something that you mentioned in your opening remarks. Well, Canadians need to be aware of the fact that according to the latest UN peacekeeping statistics, Canada is ranked 68th in the world for peacekeeping. We have a mere 58 soldiers that are wearing the UN blue helmet. We have 1,000 Canadian soldiers in Latvia right now on the borders of Russia, leading a NATO battle group and an electronic warfare unit. So Canadian has become a highly militarized country, and our posture in the world is one of war making.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to maybe, like, you could mention briefly, I mean, you say that that we're aligning with the Nazi elements in right now. I mean, how? I mean, because that's something that's considered disinformation, not just by politicians, but even the media, that this is something that the Russians are trying to cook up. I mean, could you maybe just give us a couple of examples that solidify this, you know, the Nazification, if you will, of the Ukrainian army?
Well, we know from, for instance, from reporting that military analyst and journalist David Pugliese with the Ottawa Citizens has done, showing that the Canadian military has been training neo-Nazi militias in Ukraine. There are pictures of Canadian soldiers standing alongside the Azov soldiers. And we know from access to information documents, I have copies of these documents, that Azov is a neo-Nazi force in Ukraine. And we have not only been training them, but we have been supplying them with weapons. So since 2017, Global Affairs Canada put Ukraine on the approved list for arms exports. And we have been flooding Ukraine for the past 6 years with millions of dollars of assault weapons, of ammunition, and other military equipment. We need to have a truth and reconciliation process about what Canada is doing in this war, as well as a way to end the war. We need to be honest about what Canada and other NATO countries have been doing in Ukraine, because as people like Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, Dr. John Mearsheimer, Jacques Bode, a senior Swiss military officer who has written extensively about this war, as they have said and as they have published, what is happening in Ukraine is really a NATO proxy war against Russia.
Well, you're talking about NATO now. I'm wanting to talk about how Canadian foreign policy, as you learned about it both in theory and, I suppose, your own personal life, what role did NATO play in shaping this policy? I mean, it seems as if, as time goes on, we seem to be more and more hawkish. So, you know, explain how NATO, or you can disagree if you like, but how NATO is actually dragging us into this more wartime mentality?
Well, it has been going on for 25 years, and Canadians just need to look back at the history. Since Canada was involved in the NATO bombing of the former Yugoslavia in 1999, that destabilized the government and broke up the country. And that was an illegal war. That was an illegal operation. And Canada bombed civilian infrastructure. We bombed and killed civilians. And there was never any accountability. And that illegal NATO operation in the former Yugoslavia paved the way for NATO's operation and war and brutal occupation in Afghanistan for 20 years. Canada led a combat mission in Kandahar in the south of Afghanistan. We were there for 12 years. Again, we totally destroyed the country. And then Canada led the NATO bombing of Libya in 2011 that again destroyed civilian infrastructure, killed civilians. And then Canada participated in the NATO bombing operations of Syria and Iraq from 2014 to 2016. And then we supplied the fuel for the U.S.-led coalition airstrikes in those two countries until 2019. And so Canadians need to consider this war in Ukraine in the broader context of what Canada has been doing with NATO for the past 25 years. And so not only have we been participating in these really deadly and murderous operations, but Canada has been helping to militarize Eastern Europe with NATO for the past 25 years. So we have been moving in NATO battle groups and different military installations like missile defense systems into Eastern Europe that has been just antagonizing and provoking Russia. And it defies, you know, commitments that we made after the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s to not move NATO towards Russia's border. But we have been doing that and acting so aggressively with NATO in other countries that that this has really contributed to the war in Ukraine. And I want to share an important resource with people. In 2019, the preeminent expert for U.S.-Russia relations, Dr. Stephen F. Cohen, wrote a really important book called War with Ukraine? From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. And this was the last book that he published before he died. And he wrote it as a warning. He saw that the United States and NATO were creating the conditions in Ukraine for the past 10 years that has led to this war that we see right now.
Well, when we're talking about Canadian foreign policy, I mean, there's also the tempting question to ask, with Canadian embassies that you set abroad, is there anything suspicious about their behavior that, far from aligning with the will of Canadians, actually aligns with a very vicious and ultimately illegal activity?
Well, so Canada, of course, has an embassy in Kyiv. It has an embassy in Riga, Latvia. And I have recently filed access to information requests to find out how the Canadian government is spending its local funding initiative accounts. So the Canadian officials through the embassies are able to provide funding to local groups. And I am convinced that Canada is contributing to destabilization efforts, Russophobic efforts in Eastern Europe, and complementing the work of the CIA Front Group, the National Endowment for Democracy. You know, the National Endowment for Democracy had spent hundreds of millions of dollars in Ukraine, you know, over the past 20 years to turn the public against Russia and, you know, towards the United States and NATO and the European Union. There were polls that were taken in the early 2000s that showed that Ukrainians were opposed to joining NATO. They were opposed to joining the European Union. They wanted a trilateral type of agreement, something that they could trade and have economic ties with the European Union as well as maintaining it with Russia. But the current EU leadership and the United States, you know, wanted to pull Ukraine away from Russia, you know, closer to the European Union and to NATO. And in order to turn the Ukrainian public it required a massive propaganda campaign, and I am convinced that Canada has been contributing to it. And so, you know, I will await my returns on access to information requests to see how the Canadian embassies have been operating in Eastern Europe. But I don't trust at all what the Canadian government has been doing with NATO and other countries.
Okay, I mean, we've got about 5 minutes left. I wanted to touch base with you on your visit to Russia, because that took place, I guess, in December, I think, of last year. I mean, what did you learn about that? Well, what did you see? What did you learn? And how did it grasp in yourself a sense of how the peace can be achieved?
So I went to Russia once I finished being at the climate summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. I realized that I would be able to get a direct flight from Cairo to Moscow. And I really wanted to go to Russia because there is a travel ban by the federal government for people to go to Russia. And Canadians should know that our federal government refused to engage in any diplomacy with Russia before Russia invaded on February 24th of last year. Canada refused to participate in diplomacy, and I wanted to do what the federal government should be doing, engaged in a form of diplomacy, so civilian diplomacy. I went with the motivation of people-to-people diplomacy, of peace building. I went to Moscow and to St. Petersburg for my first time. I was a little bit anxious before I went. I was expecting the country to be, architectured maybe to be austere and kind of gray Soviet style. I thought the people might be unfriendly because I can't speak any Russian. I know very little about the country. But I was absolutely astounded. I was so impressed. The people were so kind and helpful. The cities are absolutely beautiful and modern. I mean, these are world-class cities. I reached out and I had an opportunity to speak at MIGIMO University, which is the most prestigious university for international relations, and to speak to the students there and to hear their perspective on the war. It was amazing.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess we've got maybe a couple of minutes left. There's a global week of action to end the war in Ukraine coming next week. We heard a little bit about it from Glenn Michaelchuk and Ken Stone. May I ask, what will you be doing that week?
So I will be organizing a rally in Waterloo on Tuesday, October 3rd, from 5:30 to 6 at the Waterloo Public Square. And I will also be hosting a webinar on Sunday, October 8th at 4 p.m. with Jacques Baude. And he is going to be speaking about his new book, Ukraine Between War and Peace. Jacques Baude is a very credible military analyst about this war in Ukraine. I encourage people to come out and support the Week of Action to end the war in Ukraine and to join the webinar. People can find out more if they go to the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. The website is peaceandjusticenetwork.ca.
Okay. Tamara Lawrence, thank you so much for sharing with us, and I guess we'll all have a chance to participate in our own way in this week of peace. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Tamara Lawrence, a major peace activist, a member of the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace, and a PhD candidate. She's reached us from Toronto.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
I would like to welcome back to the stage now a favorite analyst of mine. He's been known to me since 2002 when he was saying emphatically that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's the kind of voice that now people should actually listen to before making a major decision in the field of military combat. Scott Ritter is a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer and author of Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, Arms Control, and the End of the Soviet Union. He served in the Soviet Union as an inspector implementing the INF Treaty in General Schwarzkopf's staff during the Gulf War, and from 1991 to 1998 as a UN weapons inspector. He joins us now to talk about the dynamics of the enterprise in Ukraine and a little about his trip to Russia earlier this year. Scott, it's great to have you back on the Global Research NewsHour. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
The great counteroffensive that we were talking about by the Ukrainians amounted to minor games and a spectacular loss of life. Ukraine deaths, I believe, soar into the hundreds of thousands now. And Russians have suffered too, of course, but and NATO countries are starting to run out of resources to send a diminishing army. Now, I have to ask, from your vantage point as a military expert, what is your analysis of the war as it stands right now? I mean, can you give us an update?
Well, I mean, what we're looking at is the strategic defeat of the Ukrainian armed forces. Even minor gains is far too optimistic, because a gain has to indicate some sort of progression to an objective. The objective of the counteroffensive was never to capture a village that had a pre-war population of 400. I'm referring to the village of Robotino. That's in Zaporizhia. That has been at the center of the counteroffensive since its start back in early June. Robotino was supposed to be the point of entry by Ukraine into the Russian defense network. They should have captured or cleared Robotino on day two of the operation. They should have been at Tokmak, which is the intermediate objective, a town some 20 kilometers beyond the front line. And then they should have been at Melitopol, the major city, which was the ultimate goal of this offensive, capturing Melitopol, severing the land bridge between Russia and Crimea, and putting the Russians in an untenable situation, thereby hoping that Russia would come to the negotiating table. And so unless you take Melitopol and sever the land bridge, you can't speak of a gain, because the gain has to be seen in the context of the totality. The Ukrainians have successfully taken Robotino, but only after they deployed the last three brigades of the 12 brigades they allocated for the task of capturing Melitopol. And having seized Robotino, they found that they had seized nothing more than a death trap, because Robotino was in the low ground between a series of high grounds continued to be occupied by the Russians. And when you have the high ground, you have a superior fire position. And the Ukrainian counteroffensive has stalled. They have no more reserves. They committed their last reserves. The Russians, meanwhile, continue to hold the totality of their defensive line. They have hundreds of thousands of troops that have yet to be committed into this fighting. And, their defense industry is churning out war materiel at record numbers with no indication of not being able to sustain this level of production. Meanwhile, Ukraine's defense industry is non-existent. They're totally dependent upon military production coming from the West, from Europe, from the United States. The Western nations have already indicated that they have pretty much exhausted their relevant stockpiles of equipment to send to Ukraine. They are struggling to get new production online. And this means that Ukraine will not be able to replenish the losses that they have suffered. This means as this war goes on and as the meat grinder grinds away, gaps will be appearing in Ukrainian the defense line and defense capacity, gaps that cannot be replenished, and these gaps will be further exploited by the Russians, creating more gaps. And this is a recipe for collapse, and I think that's the direction that we're heading on the Ukrainian front, toward the ultimate collapse of the Ukrainian military's ability to maintain some sort of cohesive front against the Russians.
Well, with this collapse appearing to signaling the end of the war in some sense, as it's got a head somewhere. You've got Zelensky still, you know, going around. He was in Canada last week, somewhat infamously, in terms of the Canadian Parliament. And I'm wondering, is he still going to be president a year from now or 6 months from now? I mean, what do you predict will be his fate with his glorious war, as you said, coming crashing down?
Well, I mean, we need to understand that Zelensky is not Winston Churchill. He is a tool of Western intelligence, of Western governments who used him to manipulate Ukraine into serving as a proxy of NATO in a larger conflict against Russia. He is an actor who has been ably reading scripts handed to him by his CIA and MI6 masters. And he had a successful first season, we could say. The show was well written. And the product was seen by the viewership as being worthy of continued support. But the second season has not been so successful. The second season, I guess we could have called it the season of the counteroffensive. And the counteroffensive has failed egregiously. And now the West is stuck with an actor whose script no longer motivates. When he went on this most recent trip, starting off by traveling to the United Nations, where he spoke before the General Assembly, as he left Europe, we saw Poland begin to turn its back on Ukraine. And this is a very, very problematic issue for Ukraine. Poland is one of the larger supporters of Ukraine. Poland serves as a conduit, a physical conduit of munitions being sent to Ukraine. Polish personnel have fought by the tens of thousands in Ukraine on the side of the Ukrainian army as mercenaries. Poland has turned over significant numbers of tanks, artillery pieces, infantry fighting vehicles. And now Poland has said they will no longer participate in that, that they will no longer send military equipment to Ukraine, that this military equipment, especially the newer equipment that's being produced in Poland and being purchased abroad, will be used exclusively for the Polish military. Moreover, Poland has said that it will not participate in the Black Sea grain deal, meaning that Poland will not allow Ukraine to dump its grain on the Polish economy. Poland is more concerned about their own farmers, their own agriculture, how to bring those crops to market, how to earn money for these farmers so they can pay taxes so that Poland can do the things Poland needs to do. By allowing Ukrainian grain into the Polish market, they severely undercut the Polish farmer in terms of pricing. Plus, the quality is garbage. Much of this grain has been sitting in silos for years and has rotted and is fermented. And, so it's sub quality grain. But this is problematic for Ukraine because if it can't bring the grain to market, it can't generate money that it desperately needs. And so having Poland turned its back on Zelensky and on Ukraine was basically the precursor for what turned out to be a disastrous trip. He went to the United Nations General Assembly, spoke before the global community to a largely empty, an empty conference room. The people that flocked to hear him in the past no longer care with what he says because he's irrelevant. He's recognized as having zero relevance to this issue. He's a puppet. If you want to negotiate with a puppet, understand that you have to negotiate with the puppet handler. And so people are starting to say, we're going to talk with the United States and Europe. We're not going to talk with Ukraine because Ukraine doesn't do anything on its own volition. So a disastrous. He went to Washington, D.C., got snubbed by Congress. The last time he was in Washington, D.C., he was able to speak to a joint session in the United States Congress, had Nancy Pelosi infamously hold up a Ukrainian flag signed by so-called defenders of Bakhmut, many of whom are affiliated with right-wing, political parties. He got her to say Slava Ukraina, which is the war cry of the Banderist movement, which Zelensky has been fronting for. He went to the Pentagon and was told, you're going to have to basically get some victories on the battlefield before we can go back to Congress and get more money. And then with his tail between his legs, he flew off to Canada. Here he met with Prime Minister Trudeau, in the Canadian Parliament and got several rousing, ovations from the Parliament as he delivered his presentation. But near the end of his presentation, the camera panned to an individual in the audience who stood up to receive the applause of Zelensky, Trudeau, and others, including the totality of the Canadian Parliament. This was a 98-year-old former soldier with the 12th Galician SS or Waffen SS Division, one of a Nazi formation, and everybody who served in it, had to be a Nazi, taking an oath to serve Nazi Germany. The 14th Galician Division, had a reputation well earned during the war of killing innocent civilians, killing Jewish women, children, the elder men, killing Poles, killing Belarusians, killing Russians themselves. A very, very criminally laced organization. In 1945, when the war ended, the Galician Division was captured intact by the British Army, I believe. And instead of being turned over to the Soviets for retribution, well-deserved, instead, they kept them under British custody, turned them into what they called displaced persons who were interned in several camps throughout Germany. And eventually, the Galician Division was dispatched from Germany to Canada en masse, the totality, where they were absorbed by the Western Ukrainian diaspora there in Ukraine. This gentleman was singled out. He stood up. And he received a standing ovation from Parliament. Parliament literally applauded a Nazi. Yeah. Now, the Speaker of the Parliament has quit. He apologized. He puts the blame on him. But I will tell you this. I have spoken before the Canadian Parliament before. It was a Foreign Relations Committee. But I had to be thoroughly vetted by the Canadian Royal Mounted Police and by the Canadian Intelligence Services before I was allowed to enter and have connection with these parliamentarians. The security for Zelensky and for Trudeau is even greater. There's not a single person in the parliament that wasn't known by name to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Canadian Intelligence Services, but they had to have their names submitted in ahead of time to be vetted. So the Canadian Security Services knew exactly who this guy was and what his background was. Moreover, it appears that Trudeau and Zelensky had arranged to meet this guy ahead of time, which means that's a further level of clearance, meaning that Trudeau and his immediate handlers knew exactly who he was, and yet he met with him. Zelensky knew who he was, and yet they met with him. So to say that this was an accident where only the Speaker of the House is to blame, the Speaker of the Parliament, that this was his mistake. He resigned, taking a bullet for the boss. But the fact of the matter is Trudeau knew about it. He had to know about it. So did Zelensky, so did their security, so did the entire Parliament. When they stood up to applaud a Nazi, a literal Nazi, they claimed now it was an accident. There was nothing accidental about it. They knew who they were applauding when they applauded him. They're just not being honest about it today. This underscores the degree to which Ukrainian nationalists with, very, very odious backgrounds, people who fought alongside Nazi Germany as part of the Waffen SS, who committed horrific crimes while they served Nazi Germany, they are alive and they are willing. They are alive and they are living in Canada, in Ukraine, here in the United States. We've just turned a blind eye to them.
Mm. Wow, that's amazing. And I thank you for bringing that to our attention. I just to switch gears again, as you have articulated, there's really no hope of Ukraine pulling off a victory in this battle. So something else has to happen. And if they're going to win, either NATO troops can be convinced to join Ukrainians on the front lines, or God help us, a nuclear war could be triggered, or some sort of truce could be signed. I think that sums up all the available choices. Well, what is your guess as to which direction this US-NATO actually will go?
Well, let me just say right off the bat that this is going to be unconditional Russian victory. That's the only way this war ends, unless NATO intervenes, and then this war ends with a general nuclear exchange and it terminates all life on the planet as we know it. There will be no truce. There will be no ceasefire. There will be no frozen conflict. There will be no forever war. This war is going to end. I can't give you an exact date and time, but it will end, and it will end with Ukraine's unconditional surrender to Russia, or it will end with the absolute destruction of Ukraine. When U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham said that this conflict will be fought to the last Ukrainian, he was serious, because Americans don't care about Ukraine or Ukrainians. We only care about Ukrainians sacrificing their lives, in furtherance of an American goal of bringing harm, of pain, of hurt to Russia. So we need to understand that's the reality. This will not end any other way, either total Russian victory or general nuclear war. Now, to avoid a general nuclear war, the West is going to have to accept the reality that Russia is going to win, and they're going to win on Russian terms. And so the question is, can NATO, the United States, the collective West, accept a Russian victory? And what will they do in the face of a Russian victory? Will they abandon Ukraine, but then regroup and seek to confront Russia elsewhere? Or will they abandon Ukraine and recognize that the best way to get out of this situation is to learn to peacefully coexist with Russia and begin negotiations with Russia about a European security framework that would be acceptable both to Europe and to Russia? These are the only options. There's literally the only, in order to have a ceasefire, a truce, or some sort of negotiated settlement, you have to have all parties talking about this and ultimately be in agreement. Russia is not in agreement. They've made it clear there will be no ceasefire. So all the options you laid out appear just to be laid out for the domestic political benefit of the nations that are willing to talk about it at this stage of the game. But it will have no impact on ultimately how this war ends. This war ends when Russia decides this war ends, and no other way.
Yeah, I just appreciate your take on another aspect of the war, and that's the development of the Ukraine Reconstruction Bank. It's set up with J.P. Morgan and BlackRock, two of the biggest financial entities in the world, and it's propped up as a source to allow private investors to rebuild Ukraine after it has already suffered from its rejection by Russia and now this war. But it's probably more intended at making big money for the war contractors. And I'm thinking of like what Halliburton did in Iraq. What are your thoughts? I guess is it as benevolent as its PR says it is, or is this like the bank and the involvement of J.P. Morgan and BlackRock an example of the saying by Smedley Butler that war is a racket?
Well, war is a racket, and BlackRock is a racketeer. They're not there to help Ukraine. They're there to make money. Their bet is, as this war goes on, Ukrainian assets that right now are worth a lot of money will diminish in value. And of course, BlackRock wants to be there to buy them at the lowest possible value and then reap the rewards through predatory reconstruction. But the good news for Ukraine is that BlackRock will never have an opportunity to do any of this, because Ukraine is going to lose the war, and Russia will make null and void any arrangement that BlackRock has signed. The Zelensky government will no longer exist when this war is done, and the Ukrainian government that will replace it will not be inclined to honor any agreement made with BlackRock. So it's totally irrelevant. Nothing that BlackRock thinks or hopes will happen from this relationship with the Ukrainian government will ever reach fruition, because in order to reach fruition, you need conflict termination on terms that allow not only for the Zelensky government to stay in power, but for the Zelensky government and Ukraine to be in a superior position over Russia, one where these contractual relationships will be enforceable. That just isn't going to happen. The Russians will never enforce this, will never agree to this, and neither will any new Ukrainian government. So I'm surprised at BlackRock for doing this, because it's a very poor investment, and they're not going to be getting a good return on their dollar.
Okay, I would also like to before we run out of time, I heard that you spent time in Russia a few months ago. I would appreciate if you could just describe your experiences there, where you traveled, who you talked to, and what was your impression generally of the country this late into the war?
Well, I went to Russia in late April. I stayed there for 26 days, returned back to the United States on May 25th. I visited 12 cities during that time. The purpose of the visit was a book tour. I just had my book, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, translated into Russian and published by a Russian publishing house. And so I was doing a book tour, but in the process of doing the book tour, I was I had the opportunity to see Russia, to meet Russians, and to get a firsthand view at what the reality of Russia was. My primary objective wasn't to do a an assessment based, on where Russia was vis-a-vis the war, but rather to learn more about the Russian people, their history, their culture, the Russian soul, and to capture this information and bring it back here to the United States in an effort to better educate and inform my fellow citizens about the reality of Russia, to try and create a vaccine, so to speak, to the disease of Russophobia that has gripped the United States. When you do that, you get a feel for the reality. And right now, Russia is impacted by the reality of this conflict. It's everywhere you go. You see the Russian people rallying around their government, deeply patriotic people, supporting defense industries, supporting the troops, supporting the Putin government. I was there for Victory Day. May 9th is Victory Day, one of the biggest holidays in Russia, celebrating the victory of the alliance over Nazi Germany. And what I can say is that, I've been involved with a lot of 4th of July parades here in the United States. I was a volunteer firefighter for many years. And of course, on the 4th of July, we like to parade up and down our town and receive the applause of the admiring citizens and all that. But, basically 4th of July comes and 4th of July goes. Victory Day is forever, meaning that the Russians never lose sight of the sacrifices made by their ancestors who came before them. 27 million Soviet citizens, many of them Russians, but not exclusively so, perished in that conflict. And the Russian people feel indebted to them. So as they prepare for Victory Day, it is a it has a deeper meaning to them. It resonates with the average Russian citizen. Victory Day itself is an extremely somber day. Yes, there's a parade. Yes, there's fireworks. But it's also a day that people go to the graves, that people lay flowers at monuments. In years past, the Russians have done a parade, sort of a spontaneous parade by Russians. It's called the Immortal Regiment. It's become a formal thing. And millions of Russians fill the streets in a parade where they hold up the photograph of a relative, from World War II, somebody who served, and it's now expanded to anybody who served. And this is a hugely emotional moment where people are actively participating in something, showing appreciation for their relatives, telling their relatives that the current generation has not forgotten their sacrifices and will never betray the cause, which is Mother Russia, that people died for. This extends beyond May 9th and the days afterwards. It still resonated. If I went to Russia today, it would still be resonating. People would still be talking about the importance, because this is part of their DNA, this patriotic desire to serve their nation. It's a real deal. And I witnessed that. And, and it's imperative to tell the American people that this is not propaganda. This is not Russian propaganda. This is genuine. This is real. This is visceral. This is who the Russian people are. And I'd also report back that Russia is not being negatively impacted by the economic sanctions, that the Russian economy was thriving. Without exception, every local economy seemed to be doing well. There was new construction everywhere. Russia is a clean nation. Russia is a well-functioning nation. Russia is a nation that appears to have compassion for its collective population. I didn't see homeless camping out under bridges or in parks or under bushes. I didn't see drunks and drug addicts crowding the streets, invading parks. The country was full of a vibrant people who were very proud of who they are. This wasn't a propaganda exercise. This was a Russian reality. And I would just encourage anybody who could travel to Russia to see it for yourself. And what you'll do is you'll come back with a deep appreciation of Russia, its culture, its history, its people, but also a recognition that everything the Western governments and Western media have told you about Russia is a lie. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that Russia is perfect, that it doesn't have problems. It does. It's not perfect. I'm not going to pretend that everything that Russia does on the world stage is admirable and beyond critique. No, some of it is as selfish as what America does. And, every nation should be open to be criticized by its own people. But when you do the balance sheet between the sins of Russia and you look at and compare it with the sins of America and the sins of Europe, you realize that Russia has very few sins, whereas Europe and the United States have a tremendous amount of sins. Russia's on the right side of history. They're trying to be good global community members. They don't want to dominate the world. They just want to be in the world as equals in a world that respects Russia as much as Russia respects them.
I guess in the 1 minute, we've got 1 minute left in this broadcast. I mean, is there anything you could say? I mean, next week is the Global Day of Action to end the war in Ukraine, October 1st to October 8th. I was wondering if anything from your knowledge of Russia and their people, what you could say that would maybe emphasize in people's minds that, yes, peace is on the way if we do things right. I mean, what would you say to those activists?
I would tell the activists that the best path to peace is the total Russian victory, that you need to stop arming the Ukrainians, you need to stop funding the Ukrainians. This war is not going to end with some sort of negotiated settlement that where everybody feels good about this. Ukraine has lost this war, and the reason why Ukraine lost this war is because the West pushed it into this conflict and then continued to pump Ukraine full of weapons and money to sustain this war. Russia is not going to end this war without achieving the objectives that it set out to achieve, and therefore the world needs to respect this. And if you stop sending them the weapons and the money that is being used by proxy to ensure that future generations of Ukrainians will grow up in dislocated environment, poor education, no stability, a nightmare. If you care for Ukraine, pray for a Russian victory.
Scott Ritter, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking to Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer and a major geopolitical analyst.
Next week, I will be passing the mic over to another individual who will conduct an interview examining the way the failure of the treaties between treaty commissioners and indigenous chiefs was not a result of misunderstandings, but the result of deliberate deception on the part of the Canadian government. Join us in 7 days.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.